2007 meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. Anybody is in the audience for House Bill 3088. We are not going to be taking that up this morning. We will be carrying it over to our next meeting, which is Monday. I can't remember what date that is, but whatever.
It's the meeting, Friday.
June 4th.
Meeting Friday?
Are we not meeting on
next
Friday?
Month?
We're not meeting on Friday.
Well, very good.
And so, let's take the other two bills in order. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3126. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3126 sets conditions for conducting an audit or review of accounts and fiscal affairs of municipal corporations. You have the -4 amendment from Representative Thatcher, which replaces the original measure. It deletes receipts from calculating the threshold requiring the audit. It declares an emergency, taking effect upon passage.
You may not have the -4. It should be in your packet.
The very last page.
Okay, I have the -4s, and we have two people signed up to testify on this bill. Three, actually. Chuck Hibner, Phil Hopkins, and Ray Fields. Would the three of you like to come forward?
In the middle.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And whoever wants to go first, please go ahead.
Chairman Rosenbaum, thank you very much. Representative Thatcher, thank you. Representative and the rest of you, thank you very much. My name is Ray Fields, and I'm the chairman of the McMinnville Royal Fire Protection District Board. And like you, I'm an elected official. And as such, I feel a keen sense of responsibility to taxpayers of my district to be sure that their dollars are spent wisely. I'm sure that as elected officials, you share that responsibility. First of all, I want to thank Representative Thatcher for introducing the bill for us and at my request. What originally precipitated this request occurred several years ago when McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District received a $20,000 grant that was passed through to the city of McMinnville. Under the current statute, the threshold to determine when a municipal corporation needs to have an audit versus a review is when the sum of the revenues and expenses exceeds $500,000. As I recall, the sum of McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District's revenues and expenses that year exceeded the $500,000 by approximately $30,000. The cost of the audit versus the review was substantially more. The sum of the grant to pass through was $40,000. This fiscal year, McMinnville Rural Fire effectively spent $3,800 to audit how we spent $3,100. That was not passed through to the city of McMinnville or paid to the auditor for the prior year's audit. And you can see page 4 of my testimony, which you should have copies of, is a spreadsheet that shows that. House Bill 3126, as originally introduced by Representative Thatcher, addresses three issues. The first issue is to define the terms audit and review, as these terms are not currently defined in the statute. The second issue is to clarify within the statute the municipal corporation does either an audit or review, one or the other, but not both. The third is to raise the threshold at which municipal corporation is required to do an audit as opposed to review for a file to file a financial statement in lieu of an audit and review. Since the first hearing was canceled, I've had a chance to visit with the representatives of the Secretary of State's Office Audit Division, the two gentlemen who are sitting on either side of me at this point. I've learned that the term review, as it is used in this chapter, has at least two different meanings. I would suggest that the term's meanings really need to be defined at some point in time so that it is not just understood by accountants. It may take a different solution than originally proposed, therefore I do not wish to pursue that issue at this time. This takes care of the first two issues that I raised in the original bill. The third issue deals with raising the threshold at which either an audit, review, or filing in lieu must be done. In the last session of the legislature, Representative Esquivel introduced a bill that eliminated the consideration of revenues in determining a threshold and also raised the threshold slightly. His bill passed the House unopposed, however, it died on the Senate side. We're here today to ask that you amend the portion of the statute that sets the thresholds and how they are determined. It seems that everyone is in agreement that the threshold level should be raised, as these numbers were set back in 1977. The McMinder Rural Fire Protection District is asking the legislature to take into account the value of money at the time in 1977, when the legislation was passed that established the upper limits of $150,000 and $500,000. I did some research and found a website called measuringworth.com. In work done by Samuel Williamson, five ways to compute the relative value of U.S. dollar amount, 1790 to 2005. And if you look at that chart, which you should have in copies of the written testimony, you'll find that both those values actually have tripled. They've actually tripled since 1977. This past week, I again met with Representative Secretary of State's office to see if we could reach a compromise solution over other issues raised originally in the original version of House Bill 3126 and some proposed amendments. What I hear is there is a greater desire for accountability in government. I cannot disagree. However, once again, we are running into a term with two different meanings. In my case, I want to be more accountable to the taxpayers of my district that we are spending their money wisely. I do not consider spending $3,800 to account for how we spent $3,100 on expenses that did not go to another audited municipal agency pursuant to a contract for services to be accountable to the taxpayers. However, that being said, at this time, I would like to eliminate the consideration of pass-through payments in determining the threshold so that we can thoroughly examine the implications of this provision and hopefully, in the interim, develop language that will be acceptable to the parties for further modification of statute, possibly in the February 2008 special session. All this being said, what we are left with to adjust the threshold are the following options. Simply increase the numbers to account for change in the value of the dollar when the provision was passed by the legislature in 1977, or eliminate the consideration of revenues and rely on expenditures. The second method, while not bringing the threshold level to today's dollars, it does effectively double the threshold. For McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District, it would move us from a full-blown audit back to review. We would save approximately $1,000 in fees. We recommend that at this time we eliminate revenues from the consideration of determining the threshold to determine when a municipal corporation should have an audit versus a review or file in lieu of review or audit. Our agreement at this time calls for leaving the numbers at $150,000 and $500,000. Eliminating revenues effectively doubles the current threshold. While it doesn't bring us to today's dollar values, it is a step in the right direction. Passage of the bill will have no impact on either the state's revenues or expenses. It will certainly have an impact on revenues of those licensed CPAs that are doing audits or revenues on small districts like the McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District. Our concern here is saving the taxpayers' money and not protecting CPAs' revenues. Somebody's ox is being gored, and it shouldn't be the taxpayers. And finally, the emergency clause is in the bill so that it will be applicable for this fiscal year. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I might interrupt for a moment. Mr. Fields, we found the audit copies that you had requested that we look for, and we've distributed those to the members of the committee now. So that's what you have is a copy of the audit that was done. Did you wish to speak on that, Mr. Fields?
When you look at the audit shows simply that we spent $283,000. And when you look at the financial statement, which is part of the on page 4 of my testimony, you'll see three columns. And the first one is the first column is shows $283,341.74. When you look at the per pack pages past that, you will see copies of the audit from the city of McMinnville. And where those particular line items show up, they don't show up in our audit.
And so, Ray, you're speaking in favor of the Dash 4 amendments.
Yes, I am.
And if I understand them correctly,
we're going to look at the.
They simply exclude receipts from the threshold amount and
right.
Base whether there's an audit or not on expenditures only.
Right.
Okay. Why don't we have questions until we heard from the other two witnesses? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. For the record, Chuck Kibner, Director of the Audits Division. With me today is Phil Hopkins. He's our audit manager for our municipal audit function. And if you have any questions specific to municipal audit, law or application, I'll be more than happy to defer to Phil on those things. I did pass out some written testimony. We had other written testimony prepared, and I can get you a copy of that if you like, for the prior bill, address some of our concerns with some of the issues that Mr. Fields went into, and we certainly understand his concerns and have agreed to look at some of those other things over the interim. But the threshold issue was something that had been hammered out to some extent last session. We understood there was agreement on adjusting those thresholds. It hadn't been adjusted some time, and the simple approach of reducing, excluding revenues and looking just at expenditures was a reasonable approach and seemed to adjust to some extent. Under our other hat of accountability, you know, that's what we try to inspire is accountability, and a lot of the work we do, if not all of it, is directed at accountability. And I understand Ray's point of view on accountability. I just want to be sure that the thresholds that everybody agrees to, and it's got to be everybody. I mean, it's not us. We run the municipal auto law. We certainly have an interest in it, but where the threshold's set really is with you. Just to make sure that everybody understands, you know, what it is that's going to happen to the current situation, we did provide a graph under the new thresholds. You can see where on page 2 of our testimony, people will slip from municipalities will go from an audit to a review. You can kind of move from left to right in that graph. You'll see how they come out of the audit, move into the review category, and some will move from the review to the self-reporting model. And you know, that probably makes some sense. How much of that you want to have happen, you know, it really is up to a body like yourself to determine. We're certainly fine with the amendment that addresses the threshold. We have agreed to speak with Ray about the pass-through issues in the interim. It may be a more formal arrangement. You may decide that you would like a more formal arrangement, and that would be fine, too. We just want to be certain that whole law of unintended consequences is totally understood, so they're intended consequences, and that we're doing what makes sense for everybody, not just for McMinn Mill Rural Fire. So we'll certainly be willing to work with them on that. And, Phil, if you've got any additional comments or just want to hold for questions.
Okay. Questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at the little chart, you know, have there been problems found in the in lieus in the past? You know, you've got 413 of these municipals have done in lieu in the past. Were there ever problems that came up as the Secretary of State's office reviewed those?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin. For the record, my name is Phil Hopkins, Audit Manager with the Audits Division. The in lieu, those who file in lieu reports, the one nice thing about it that's in the law is that should a citizen in any community wish to have an audit performed, like for instance, they don't trust the fact that somebody just filed those reports, they can petition to have an audit done. And that happens about once a year. Some small cities, some small districts says, you know, I don't, you know, these. We're not being subjected to an external review or an audit, and so we want to. They can petition and have an audit done, and then they file it with us, and I say yes, and then I help them to get a firm come in and do it. So there's those kind of issues. We review those reports each year also, and we kind of like do a little quick review because the financial information that is submitted is pretty simple. We don't ask for a whole lot. But, you know, the problems are minor. You know, they have to do with fidelity bond coverage or not reporting the right amounts. And we write back to them and tell them what's right. But I think it works pretty well.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember this from last session. I believe we heard it down in Medford. Substantively, how different is the dashboard to this to what was passed out of the House last session? Do you folks remember?
Phil, do you want to handle that since you were...
Yeah, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger. This, what happened last session was that we put this formula change in, but it also raised the 150 mark from an in lieu to a review to 250,
right,
and changed the other one from 500,000 to 600,000. And it was that additional increase that concerned some parties because it had both elements in there. This one just changing the formula, everybody was on board with. But when they put one on top of the other, that caused some problems.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, by excluding receipts and only considering expenditures, that's not going to mean that you will not be looking at receipts when you do an audit. It just means that they won't be counted toward the threshold. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, exactly.
Okay. So any audit you do would still include both sides?
It would review both. It's just the math for determining what review you need.
Okay.
And Chair Rosenbaum, if I might just add one other little thing. When we did our analysis last time about the impact of these changes, is that in terms of accountability, in terms of total receipts and expenditures for all local governments, all 1,650 of them, before we changed this formula, we had coverage, external audit coverage, like 99.85% of total dollars of being subject to an external review. With this change, it's still going to be 99.34%. So in terms of total dollars that are passed through to local governments, still pretty good.
Spoken like a shoe auditor.
Right.
That's why I keep them around.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3126, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 3126.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3126.
Representative Buckley moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3126. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3126 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 3126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Shauna, would you please, is there discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Well said. Shauna, please call the roll.
Seth Rowland.
Aye.
Seth Asher.
Aye.
Seth Berger.
Aye.
Seth Buckley.
Aye.
Seth Estrell.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And as this is your bill, Representative Thatcher, would you like to carry it on the floor?
I'd be delighted to. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher will carry. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3126. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3432. Mr. Stembridge, would you like to tell us about this bill?
House Bill 3432 reduces the number of members on the Board of Public Standards, Public Safety Standards and Training, that's the BPSST, from 24 to 17. It has a number of provisions in the original measure, but I would rather talk about the amendments and describe the amendments. You have five different amendments in your packet. One is from Representative Crummell. It allows persons discharged for cause to reapply for certification at a later date. And then the -5 is the basis of the next four amendments. The -5 replaces the measure. It increases the number of members of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, BPSST, from 24 to 25. It removes as ex officio voting members of the board the chief of the Portland Police Bureau, the chief of the Portland Fire Bureau, and the special agent in charge of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for Oregon. It removes as an appointed member the representative of forest protection agencies. It removes voting authority of the superintendent of the state police, state fire marshal, and the director of the Department of Corrections. They would become non-voting ex officio members. They also have the authority to send designees. The -5 amendment also provides that one of the two police chief members be from one of the state's three largest cities. It adds a second member of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. It adds as members a second representative of county or state corrections facility collective bargaining units, one representative of the statewide association of community correction directors, one non-management parole and probation officer employed in community corrections, and a second public member. It changes the membership of BPSST policy committees as well. It adds, and these policy committees are made up of, they are subcommittees of the board. It adds as a subcommittee of the board a seven-member certification review committee with authority to process determinations of denial, revocation, or suspension of certification based on failure to meet established standards. It requires the Certification Review Committee to establish the fitness for duty standards. There, in addition to those provisions, there are arbitration options. The dash 5 has no arbitration mention in it. The dash 4 is the same as the dash 5 with the addition that the committee is prohibited from finding differently from arbitration decision, if any, in the matter when processing a denial, revocation, or suspension of certification. The dash 6 is the same as the dash 5 with the variation on arbitration that the committee examine the underlying basis of an arbitration decision when processing the denial, revocation, or suspension of certification. And the last one is the dash 7, which is the same as the dash 5 with a third variation on arbitration that the committee give due deference to an arbitration decision in the matter when processing this denial, revocation, or suspension of certification.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge.
I hope I didn't make it more difficult to understand what's going on.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
I can see why the Committee on Business and Labor has sent this to us.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Trouble is, we don't know.
Some of us have seen this before.
Can't seem to get rid of this.
I would ask Mr. Stembridge if he would at some point come up with a chart such as this that helps explain membership, who's now and what the proposals are, if you wouldn't mind, at some point.
I would be happy to do that.
I don't know.
And there may be a witness that has such a chart.
Yeah, I
would. Motioning from the audience.
Because verbally I can't get it, but in chart form I probably can't.
Okay, I see that Representative Krummel is in the audience, so why don't we have him come up first, because I think his amendment might be the simplest to talk about.
Madam Chair, Representative Krummel is known for making things simple and easy.
Good morning.
It's that simpleton mind. Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Thank you very much for your consideration of an amendment to House Bill 3432. I would like to introduce the Dash 2 amendments, and hopefully you all have copies of that.
Yep.
I have... let me first assure you that we've talked with all of the parties connected to the bill, and they have been aware of my desire to find a nice home for this amendment and have been very supportive. My constituent was a corrections officer who lost his job 4 years ago over a few policy violations, but his employer never intended for his termination to be listed for cause, but that's the way it ended up being presented to DPSST. He wanted to make up for his mistakes and improve his life and continue to pursue a career in law enforcement. So he went to college, got a degree, and tried to be a reserve police officer. He entered the Reserve Academy at a local police department, and then when they were about to hire him, realized that DPSST had revoked his certification. Because the termination was categorized for cause, a revocation is automatically determined to be a lifetime ban. So he, as a result, he couldn't work again. We worked on this during the interim with the agency, and that's what brings us here today. This is not an attempt to try to reinstate everyone who thinks they got a bum rap. So let me make that very, very clear. And it doesn't force the agency to reinstate anyone. All we're asking in these amendments is a chance to allow someone in this kind of a situation to have the ability to reapply for recertification, to have their case reviewed, and if DPSST feels warranted, they could restore someone's certification. But there's no guarantees in this amendment what we're proposing here. After talking with the agency, we realized their staff has also been kind of re-examining these policies, and they're not opposed to the amendments, and they actually helped us draft the language. And also, I'd like to thank DPSST and Representative Hunt and Mr. DeLashman for allowing this amendment to be considered for you today. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them. And with that, I'll stop.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Representative Krummel? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I just want to beat the the point across here. The department's not required to deny certification, correct, in your amendment, not required to deny certification, but it's also not required to recertify.
Right. That is correct. They're not required to recertify, but they can, with this amendment, they can look at the case individually, and if it's warranted and they feel a person could be trustworthy and should be recertified, it would give them the opportunity to do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your
thank
testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have several people signed up to testify. I'll call first Brian DeLashmet and Robert King.
Madam Chair and members, sit next to Robert. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Brian DeLashmet. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Let me first start off by saying that the summary that you got from staff, hopefully I can make it a little less complicated than the way it was laid out. The reason you have four sets of amendments is, as I've gone through discussions with all the parties involved, it seemed like there was a semi-consensus at one point last week. I actually thought there was consensus around a foundation of a bill, which was to be one set of amendments, and then there was supposed to be three policy options on how you deal with arbitrations. So in doing that, I have the four different sets of amendments constructed so that, you would see the policy decisions as far as the arbitration, but the base bill, in fact, is the dash fives. So the dash five, if we're working from the dash fives, let me explain a little bit about the history. The bill did come to you from the Business and Labor Committee. Three members on this panel were also members of that committee. Heard pretty extensive testimony around that. The first thing I'd like to say is that the board currently is 24 members. We felt it was much too large. In our original bill, Representative Hunt introduced the bill, would have reduced that membership down to 17 members. Six of which, and if you look at my testimony, Representative Berger, actually, I do have the chart in
there.
Yes,
see it.
If you look at page three, page four, the last page, the original bill was 17 members, and it reduced membership of a chief, a fire chief. It aligned it so that it was actually six members that were representing the different disciplines that were historically viewed as management folks, and six members that would have been viewed as historically as non-management or labor or line staff from police, fire, and corrections. Given that original bill being introduced, which I actually have been working on for a number of years, I got pushback, which is to be expected. And the pushback came after the committee, the Business and Labor Committee, heard the hearing and I think was sympathetic to the issues that were involved. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not there's adequate due process for officers as they go through the certification or decertification process. And let me explain just briefly how it currently goes. The staff, if there is a complaint brought to the DPSST staff, or if the DPSST staff through the media or any other source becomes aware of what they believe is a violation of the standards, and it could be the moral fitness standards, or it could be any other violation, they in fact begin an investigation. The investigation proceeds with the staff investigation. At some point, the staff may in fact make the determination internally that this does not have merit, and they dismiss, and it doesn't go any further. If the staff believes that there is merit in this, then currently, under the current situation, the staff recommends to the policy subcommittee, and you've heard a little bit about that, but there are three policy subcommittees, police, fire, and corrections, and there are other subcommittees as well. But the policy committee, let's say, for example, it's a police officer, they would recommend to the policy subcommittee on the police officer which is members from the police discipline from the board that moved down to the policy subcommittee along with some added members. They would suggest to them that they look at that as a policy subcommittee, and they review it and believe it has, if it has merit. So that's the first screen. The second screen, then, is the policy subcommittee believes that there's merit. They move it to the entire board of 24 members. The entire membership of the 24 members then goes through the same thing, the written documents and so forth. The one side note that I would give you is that the person who is, quote-unquote, up for revocation or potential revocation has no ability to interact with either the policy subcommittee or the full board other than in a written statement. And we had a problem with that. So that was one of the base foundations for us coming forward with some bills, with a bill which is the composition of the board correct to be able to give adequate due process? And is there some way that you, in fact, can guarantee at least more due process in setting up a new system that would accomplish a couple of things? One is the ability to interact, and the second thing is that it would abbreviate the process. So you go staff review to the policy subcommittee to the full board, and then if the full board thinks that they should proceed, then it goes to administrative law judge, who then actually holds a hearing in which everybody comes in. That process is very extended. What we've attempted to do in the original Dash 1 bill, and then now in the 4, 5, 6, and 7s, is set up a process in which, with some modification of the board, and the chart is in there, and I'll go through it in just a minute, it's not a major modification of the board, and it truly is not 25 members. It's 25 members. It has grown by one if you count the three ex officio members as also members of the board. But there's 22 voting members as compared to 24 now, and I'll go through that in a minute. What we've attempted to do in this bill, and I will again phrase this as semi-consensus amendments until we get to the arbitration, is to set up a subcommittee of the board specifically to look at certification, the certification review process, instead of having it go to the policy subcommittee, to the board, and then to the ALJ. That seven-member panel is a public member, and on the composition, there's actually now two public members instead of one out of the original 24. So we're adding a public member. One of those public members would be assigned to this group. There would be three line staff, police, fire, and corrections, and there would be three that would be considered managers, for example, a chief or a sheriff from police or fire, and corrections on that panel. Their express function would be then to instead of the screening going through the policy subcommittee and through the board, they would be the screening before it would go to an ALJ. And with that balance, we're comfortable that, in fact, there would be adequate safeguards as far as due process for the person who would be brought up on whatever the specific case is. The second piece that those members who were on the Business and Labor Committee will recall was the issue of the ability to interact. We had a number of current and former board members from the DPSSD that said, in the process the way it currently is, if the person is there, let's say the police officer is there, and they have a question about the written statement or about conflicting facts between what the officer is saying happened and either the investigation or the employer says has happened, they felt that they had no ability at all to ask a direct question for clarification to the individual to say, you know, this is what you're saying, but it doesn't quite jive. Can you tell me exactly what this sentence means? The DPSST, up until recently, and you may hear from additional witnesses, did not allow in that process that interaction. The base bill, the Dash 5, as does the 4s, 6s, and 7s, basically says that if the person is there and is attending, it's not a full-blown hearing, but if a member of that policy, that new review policy committee, wants to ask a question for the sake of clarification, they have that ability to ask a clarification question. We think that is preferable to the entire process stopping and saying to staff, well, there's some questions. We're going to set this all aside and have the staff go back, look at, you know, what happened, who said what, and then come back to us a later time. That elongates the process. So we put that provision in there. The final thing, I guess I would say, as far as the actual composition or the differences between the amendments, and you've heard from staff, is that, again, in the negotiations, there was a number of options for how they deal with arbitrations. And let me spend just a minute on arbitrations before Robert talks. When we're talking about arbitrations, we're talking about a situation in which there would be a local collective bargaining agreement between an employer and an employee. Let's say, for example, the Department of Corrections and the Association of Corrections Employees, in which if there is a grievance and it goes to arbitration, and the arbiter has a full-blown hearing and says, I understand the facts, and I've had a full hearing in which everyone came in and discussed what actually occurred, and I've reinstated that person back to the position because I don't believe they did anything wrong, then one of the options, and it's the dash fours that we've put forward, says that the DPSST cannot reverse the arbiter's decision. We feel that it's two bites at the apple, that in fact, at the local level, the arbiter has held a full case hearing, said, I found the facts, and this person didn't do anything wrong. They need to be reinstated. The dash fives are totally silent on arbitration. Our preference would be the dash fours, but if you don't choose the dash fours, we would accept the dash fives. And the reason why I feel more comfortable with the dash fives rather than the sixes or the sevens, which are two additional iterations, which I've offered because I told people I would offer them, is that we would just assume the panel of seven, and internally in DPSST, that they would in fact figure out how they're going to deal with arbitrations on an ongoing basis. There's a group that's been working on moral fitness standards and a discussion of arbitration up to this point. And rather than putting in statute some language that is contained in six or seven that they may choose is the right fit or not the right fit, we would just assume that they, in fact, have that discussion. So with that, I guess I'll close. This has been a bill that has been an adventure for me. I've been working on this issue for nearly 8 years now. Last session, I introduced the bill. It did get a hearing on the Senate side. This time, there's been a little bit more traction. I think a little bit more acknowledgement, maybe by the membership of DPSST, that there is a concern and there is an issue not only in the composition of the board, but also the due process piece. With that, if there's any additional questions on the composition, I did, as I mentioned to Representative Berger, there is the chart of the current board. You'll see down the one column what the 22 voting and 3 ex officio for a total of 25 looks like, and it's not a major deviation from the current board. It adds one additional line staff from police, fire, and corrections onto the full board. It adds a parole and probation officer who currently they're certified and they're trained by DPSST but aren't even on the policy subcommittee. They have absolutely no home at all in this board. It moves one person who represents the community corrections directors who was on the policy subcommittee up to the full board because we felt if there was going to be a parole and probation officer on the full board, there should be their employer on the full board. So we moved them. And with that, I will close my testimony. I know I took a lot of time, but there is a lot of history here on this bill, and I'd be open for any questions.
Why don't we hold questions till we've heard from our other witness? Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum. My name is Robert King. I'm a detective with Portland Police, and I'm the full-time association president. In Portland, I represent 930 police officers, sergeants, detectives, and criminalists. And I'm here today to talk to you about really just one thing, and it has to do specifically with arbitration and arbitrators' awards. Brian, I think, did a good job of outlining not only the process but a little bit of the history that these issues have gone through. I'll tell you that as a current member of the DPSST board and as a labor representative in Oregon, I have a concern, and the concern simply is that employers in Oregon of any sort, public, but police in particular, have the ability to discharge employees for cause. And there are times when they do that, and we rely on the Collective Bargaining Act, which was developed, as you know, in 73, written extensively by the governor himself, and been in play now for many, many years. It provides basic employment rights. It protects police officers and their families in a way that, given the role that they play in our community, it's the kind of protection that they need. And what we've seen happen is when employers have fired and arbitrators have reinstated. Arbitrators will say either the grievance is it's defective on procedural grounds, and they'll award for the employer or the employee. They could weigh in on the conduct itself. They could say the conduct didn't happen. The employer got it wrong. They could weigh in against us, and they could say the employer got it right, and the individual is in fact fired. They could weigh in on the conduct, even sometimes conduct that you and I might not particularly like. They could say, yeah, the conduct happened, I don't think termination is appropriate, and they could impose a lengthy suspension. We don't strike. We don't have the lawful ability to strike. We don't want to strike. We have a responsibility to protect people. We take that very seriously. I grew up as a kid marching in labor parades. My father's a member of the ILWU, International Longshoremen Warehousemen's Union. My brother's in Local 8. My dad's a walking boss in 92. Basic employee rights are critically important to me and to the people I represent. And so what we have raised on at the DPSSD board and in this legislation is the concern that we have, that we have an employer-dominated board in DPSST, and we have a process that even when arbitrators weigh in, DPSST, while they may understand our concerns, they're not particularly moved by them. And that an officer can be fired for some conduct, an arbitrator can reinstate them, and DPSST can decertify them. And when they decertify them, they take away their certificate for life. They've taken away their ability to feed their family. And I obviously, as their representative, have a real concern about that. Now, this legislation has been threatening to DPSST and has resulted in a kind of negotiation that is designed to move us towards a compromise. I appreciate the effort, frankly, the DPSST staff and the board members, and some who are here who you will hear from, will say that we have made an effort and made positive strides in a good direction. And I think to some extent that is true. However, the effort, this compromise effort, even perhaps this legislation, doesn't address the single concern that I have about the difference between employment rights and the licensing abilities to take away certification. And I don't know if it'll be solved in the compromise. I don't know if it'll be solved in this legislation. I know that I'm 42 and I don't retire for a good 10 years, and I'm going to keep coming back and delivering this message, because it's a very narrow set of cases and facts that this applies to. Of the 300 that DPSST evaluates every year, one, two, or three are arbitrator's awards where the arbitrator has reversed the employer's position. And DPSST in those cases can decertify. And I've said, if it's only one or two cases a year, why do we need to create a new committee and a new moral fitness standard? Let's just abide by the arbitrator's awards. It's good enough for the state of Washington. It's good enough for the state of California. They don't decertify on this basis. And when a court of competent jurisdiction weighs in, they abide by that. I'd like to see us be more like our sister and brother states to the north and to the south. So I don't know if that helps at all. That's really my position. I'm really clear about it. I know people don't like it or they may not agree, but that's what it is. I'd like to see us abide by arbitrators' awards. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for these witnesses? Is that a hand?
It is a hand.
A
hand.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you're telling me is you're working on the procedure and you're going about that through the board. That's what you're doing. I think that's a separate venue. The other question I have to ask you, sir, who is decertified that you would recertify, since you, quote, say they decertified this or they could? Do they, in fact, decertify every person that goes through this process?
I can Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Esquivel. I can only speak to my experience during the time that I've been on that board. There have been two cases that I am aware of where arbitrators have weighed in, and the board has recommended decertification. Now, those two cases in particular, I believe, have gone on through the appeal process to the Attorney General and then later on to an administrative law judge. So the cases that I am familiar with, yes, in fact, they have.
Have what? Excuse me, follow.
Madam Chair and Representative Esquivel, have recommended decertification.
Follow up.
Then
there's appeal process in place. Did the decertification through the law judge happen? And if so, would you reinstate that person? That's my question.
Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Esquivel, I don't know what the status of the review process is. I know that both of those, I think, were headed to an administrative law judge. But your specific question, I believe, is, given the conduct that the officers engaged in, would I personally reinstate them?
That's basically it.
You know, in our country, we let 10 innocent people go, 10 guilty people go to protect one innocent person. We don't argue what the process and what the law should be on the basis of the conduct or the egregious actions of an individual. We establish a fairness and equity. It's a fundamental principle in our law and in our system of justice in this country, and that is really the same thing that I'm suggesting to you today. We don't look at those egregious cases and say, that's bad conduct and that's why we've decertified. We want a fair process in place that we think protects us, and we don't think the one that exists today does that. And yes, I would reinstate them.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Let me, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, get to some specific process, what the process currently is. Okay, currently, it, as Mr. DeLashmit explained, you have an issue, and it goes to DPSST, it goes to the policy committee, the next step is the full board, and the next step is ALJ, correct?
Correct.
Now, where does the arbiter come in on that? That's before it ever got to DPSST, or is the arbiter ALJ? Your arbiter thing, where does that come in?
Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Berger, the arbitrator, I guess, weighs in the employment action on a separate track, and currently DPSST holds all review process until the arbitrator has made a ruling one way or another.
Got it. Okay. That's what I thought was the case. So your issue is separate in a way from this bill?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's get to this bill. Thank you for that clarification. The arbiter, if the employee wants it to go to an arbiter, it goes to an arbiter, the arbiter decides, and then this DPSST process starts. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And in two cases that you're aware of, the arbiter ruled one way and DPSST overturned their ruling.
Yes.
Okay. And two cases in how many years or how over how many cases?
Over probably several hundred cases. I've been on the board, I think, around 2 years.
Okay, so in your experience, in 2 years, two cases have been overturned,
yes.
Have overturned the arbiter. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, my understanding and from the discussions from the staff is that it does average about one or two a year. That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
The arbitration piece as a separate issue is a small number of cases.
Okay. So now, thank you for that. Now I think I've got you off the table. I understand. Now, Brian. Under Dash 5 amendments, the process would do two things, reduce and change the composition of the DPSST board, okay, and change it so, and I really appreciate your work on this because I was the one that said there ought to be a better way than going through policy committees, and DPSST ought to have a D-cert committee that works only on that, and that is in here, am I correct? And it consists of one public member, three line staff, and three managers, and they are permanently on that committee, correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, that is the Berger Amendment, and yes, they are permanently appointed to that.
Okay.
And the one, again, clarification that I stated before is there's an additional public member. There was only one on the entire board. There'll be two under this proposal. And the staff of DPSST felt that the load of this committee with the other responsibilities of the public member were too much, and they asked for a second public member, one to be assigned to this and one to the other responsibilities.
So I'll get to that in a minute. That's for another. Okay, so under this proposed amendment, never mind the things that haven't been decided in terms of, but under this amendment, a DCERT after arbitration, or if it doesn't go to arbitration, whatever, would come to this committee. Okay, this committee would make a recommendation to the board, and the board, or it would go from directly from this committee to the ALJ.
Under this proposal, it would go directly from this committee to the ALJ and would not go to the board. And again, that is a reflection of the discussion that we had in front of the Business and Labor Committee, in which a number of the board members who appeared were uncomfortable with making a ruling based upon no interaction with the individual and only seeing a stack of the written record about like this. They felt it was more appropriate for a special review committee to be doing that interaction and reviewing the panel, and then it going to a hearing to abbreviate the process.
Then if I could pursue, whoever's got the chair. Why then, what I haven't heard yet is, because I do like this system, but I wasn't envisioning that it would bypass DPSST full board altogether. I guess that wasn't in my mindset when I suggested a different. And then why then are the proposed, what is the rationale for the proposed changes to the full board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, let me take the second one first.
Okay.
The representation, with the current representation of only being three line staff on the entire group of 24, and then those staff then being funneled down to the policy subcommittee, there is a feeling amongst my membership, both in corrections, police, and parole and probation, and I am aware that the firefighters feel the same way, that they have an inability to have an adequate voice at the policy subcommittee level or the board because they only have one representative there. There's a possibility that, in fact, if that member is absent for whatever reason, it can be very valid on that day, they have absolutely no one there to really be looking out for the line staff in that particular area. So I don't want to downplay the recomposition, although I think it's minor. It is major to my members, but it is substantially different than the original bill, which had six and six and a vastly reduced amount. So the dash fours through sevens are a reflection of the pushback of some folks saying, well, we still would like to be on the board. And with the addition of the policy subcommittee configuration, having a person from parole and probation that I mentioned before being on the board and the community corrections. I have forgotten your first question. So I apologize. It's getting late in the session.
Thank you. Mr. If I could comment. Okay, and so you know where I'm going here. I really appreciate deeply you going back, because you know how unhappy I was with your original bill. And I really appreciate you going back and talking about this process issue with regard to certification. But I'm still left with the fact, Brian, that DPSST is a management organization, and I'm still not persuaded that bringing all this line staff is serving anybody but your organization and not necessarily serving the whole citizenry of the state of Oregon. So I'm left with your fundamental changes on DPSST board. You haven't resolved that for me, but I'm not saying that we aren't getting there. I'm just saying that I'm just not quite there yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thanks for clarifying your first question. Actually, if you look at the total task and function of the DPSST board, it's not just for revocations. There are a variety of issues, including training. And there is invaluable expertise among the line staff. We have, in the past, had police officers who are the training officers from the Portland Police Bureau actually be on the board. We feel it is essential for the line staff to have that ability to feed information as to what the needs of the individual line staff is in each of the disciplines to the board so that they understand what the line people feel are the needs of those folks in training, in everyday execution of their job. And so that's the primary reason for the reconfiguration of the board. It doesn't have, at this point, with the new seven-member panel, it does not have the direct nexus to the revocation process. It has the nexus to the training piece and the areas of expertise that we believe are essential for the new board.
Thank you for that. Yeah, and I have one more thing, and then I will release the microphone. How, and this may be a question for our staff as opposed to you, but I would like to kind of understand better this proposal and how it compares to, say, certification and revocation of a lawyer's license, a doctor's license, a psychologist's license, and how this would either conform or not conform to processes in other, because I think it's important, really important, what we're talking about for not only the people involved, I think you, Detective King, understand this clearly, but it's equally important if you're a doctor or any other professional, and so I'd kind of like to have a sense of how this process is different and how others, and particularly with regard to this skipping the DPSST board piece, that sort of, I somehow didn't expect that, but it's an interesting, and Brian, in all fairness, you did go out, the Berger Amendment, you did put in the piece that I want. I am not complaining at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? I had one myself. Did you have one, Representative?
Yeah.
Go, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Berger's question, looking at the comparables that you had in terms of just, you were just dealing with the size here, I realize, in terms of some other comparable boards. And I obviously appreciate all the efforts to downsize. I also understand the pushback and understand why you came out where you came out in terms of being back somewhat larger. But looking at the other comparable boards, not so much in terms of the size, but in terms of the question that Representative Berger just asked, as I, from the peripheral knowledge I have of these boards, my understanding is that the Board of Dentistry, for instance, which will play a role, which plays the role in granting, I suppose, and yanking licenses of dentists, is almost completely dentists. Board of Medical Examiners, almost completely docs. Board of Nursing, almost completely nurses. Board of Pharmacy, almost completely pharmacists, etc. So it seems like, if anything, as we look at kind of apples to apples, if that's possible with other boards, this, even under the restructured version, you still have, instead of just peers dealing with granting or decertifying, you actually still have a far greater involvement of those in an employer or management situation than any other board I'm familiar with. Is that a fair assessment or not?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Hunt, that's exactly on point. And that was one of the concerns about the entire board being the final screen as far as the discipline. It is vastly different than the Board of Nursing, which I'm very familiar with, or the Board of Medical Examiners that I'm very familiar with. It would be akin to having a super board of docs, nurses, pharmacists, dentists, everyone in the world, and having somebody in front of them when perhaps a number of the people on that panel are not your peers. They do not understand your practice clearly. And that's what we were attempting to do with not going through the full board in this process. It accomplishes two things. Is it abbreviates the process, because you need to understand this is a very long, drawn-out process just to get through the current board and then go to the ALJ, and then if you still don't like it, then you appeal through the courts. It's a very long, drawn-out process, so we were trying to abbreviate that. But we were also trying to set up a situation in which you had a more representative of your peers kind of approach. And it's very tough in this kind of a board, because this board has a number of functions and tasks beyond just, it's not just police, and it's not just fire. It's the entire world. And when you have a board of 24 that's that diverse, is it in fact a group of your peers?
Further questions? Or is there other?
Yeah, and I guess this one would be to the officer there. I'm getting back to the arbitration part, because I understand exactly where you're coming from with respect to arbitration, but even in your testimony, you acknowledge that there are times when a person may, in an arbitration, win the arbitration because procedurally they didn't follow things that were in the contract. And yet, there may have been an act that people would find egregious that happened, but because the procedures weren't done, the arbitrators were one way. And shouldn't there be a place where that kind of action can be looked at by a board that says, understand that arbitration, but this person shouldn't be in this office? I mean, as a teacher, as an administrator, and I think that's in some of those boards that are making those decisions, it's mostly teachers, but they're oftentimes much harder on the teacher than would be another group. They would say, we'll take that license because we don't think that person should be in the classroom, even though they may have... won the arbitration. And from your testimony, it sounds like you just feel the arbitration should be it, and that's it. And I guess that's a concern to me, because I think there are times, not very often, I think it's a pretty rare thing, but there are times when things happen that someone in our organizations need to be responsible for that and say, hold it, let's take a time out. I guess I just want your impression of that.
Vice Chair Buckley and Representative Roblin, I do believe that, and even in those cases that you have described, that yes, in fact, the arbitrator's ruling should be the final word. That is, while I understand the concerns that you have and the position that you've taken, that we place this this confidence and this trust in this process. It's the only predictability and reliability we have in our relationship with our employer when our jobs are at stake. And so after this. We think neutral and independent arbitrator has weighed in that we have a better chance at fairness and equity in that setting than in what has historically been the DPSST's employer-dominated board.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Roblin, if I may weigh in a little bit, let me first say no one, as you had stated, as far as teachers are harder than on teachers than teachers.
Right.
Police officers, firefighters, and corrections are exactly the same way. The second thing I would say is that in the arbitration or in the representative process by a labor organization, they have the ability to say, no, we're not going to take this to grievance and ultimately to arbitration because we think you stink. You absolutely are horrible, and you shouldn't have done what you have done. But once they've made that decision that, in fact, they're going to back this person and they have gone to the expense and the time, then what I hear Robert saying is, and the arbitration has, in fact, upheld their position, then it shouldn't be reversed. But I wanted to make it very clear that we're not making an attempt here to protect some bad apples. Very clear that, again, no one is harder on these folks than their peers.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Members, we have a witness here who's traveled from more than 100 miles, Shane Hagee, who would like to testify against.
I need to pass it on to Representative Berger.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Shane Hagee. For the record, I'm the Director for Community Corrections for Jackson County, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors today. And I'd like to say that over the past 18 years, I've worked in the criminal justice system, have had a great deal of contact with DPSST over those years. I've served as a corrections officer, as a police officer, and also as a probation and parole officer. I've attended all the academies. Over the past few years, I've also served as a member on the Corrections Policy Committee as a jail commander, and now currently I serve on that same committee as a community corrections director. And up until this point, I felt like I have a pretty good understanding of how DPSST operates, their processes, and this piece of legislation is somewhat confusing. There's a lot of amendments, a lot of things that go with it that cause some concern to me. As an association, we have been trying over the past year to put ourselves in a position where we do have representation as probation and parole. We are a separate discipline, and we haven't been recognized as that on the board of directors. We've been working collaboratively with the academy, with the policy committees, towards those efforts to get more representation. With that being said, we have something to gain from this piece of legislation as an association because it does include us as a member on this board. With that being said, our association is in opposition to 3432. I don't believe that what is represented in this legislation solves the problems at the academy. There are some problems and things that could be improved upon, things that we could change and make some processes more efficient. But the way this legislation is put together, I believe it just creates different problems. It doesn't solve the problems necessarily the way they're set up there. And I think working collaboratively with DPSSD through our policy committees, I think we can solve some of these problems without putting in place legislation that is, at the very least, very confusing. And there's so many amendments to this. I just think that it's a poor piece of legislation, and OACCD is opposed to this. And I've submitted written testimony, and that's really all I needed to say.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Hay, Mr. Representative Hunt?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you tell us, I mean, in terms of the parts of the bill that you're concerned about, is it dominantly the new composition of the DPSST board, or is it dominantly the function and composition of the Certification Review Committee?
I think it's both. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt. I have a problem with how the reduction from 24 down to 17 was achieved. I think it's confusing. I think there should have been more collaboration between the members of that board, because whoever is going to be removed from that board, there should have been more discussion, I think, at the board level and at the academy level with those folks involved. And I believe that although there could be some changes that would be effective, part of that is including us as part of that board. I don't believe that process was followed accurately. I think it should be done differently. And your second question, Representative Hunt?
In terms of the Certification Review Committee?
The Certification Review Committee, currently that's done at the Policy Committee level. I have a concern that the members that are put on that review committee now don't represent all the disciplines within DPSST, one of those being probation and parole. For the most part, I think those are decisions that can be made probably independent of the profession that you're working within, but there are issues that come up. Having done that for several years as a representative, as a jail commander representative, and also as community corrections, I think that there are issues that come up sometimes that are specific to that profession that may not be able to be answered directly by members on that committee the way they're laid out. So I think we need to have equal representation if it's going to be a board like that. But ultimately, I think that it's handled well right now at the policy level. I don't think we need to create a new policy committee. I think there are enough processes involved already.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have a panel here. Harold Severs, Bob Wolf, and Todd Anderson. Would like to come up as a panel? Please proceed.
Madam Vice Chair Berger, representatives of the committee. I am Harold Burke Sivers. I am the chair of the board for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I just want to start off by saying how much I appreciate the work of Mr. DeLashmid and Mr. King in really talking about these issues. I became chair of the board less than a month ago, and I found out in a 38-year history of the board, there's only been two emergency meetings of the board, and I've called both of them because I wanted to show how seriously that we want to address the issues that are being brought forward here. And I very much appreciate the work that's been done. So I just want to kind of give you an idea of what has been done so far. When we had the first meeting, I just said, what really are the issues here? And there were three that were brought forward. One, they said that the moral fitness standards were too vague, that the language was could be open to subjective interpretation. So we looked at that, and we said, you know, you're right. So we formed this certification review committee. One of their tasks is made up of three management, three labor, and one private citizen to take a look at these moral fitness standards. And we've been working to add some more specificity around that language to make it less vague. So that's still an ongoing process, ongoing work. The second thing that they talked about was the arbitration, which you've heard so much about this morning. And here's what our issues are with that. The current practice for DPSST is, first we have to recognize that with an arbitration, that's a labor relations employment issue, and DPSST is a certification. There's two different standards here. But the current practice is if an arbitrator makes a decision and they find that there's no basis for the conduct that the officer did, then DPSST will administratively close the case. It won't even go any further than that. So if an arbitrator says, you know what, there's no basis for the conduct that they're saying this officer did, DPSST won't even look at it. That's the current practice right now. It wasn't in writing, so we put it in writing. That is what we will put in writing what we said that we currently do. The piece that concerns us are the other two cases. For example, if an arbitrator is looking at the employment issue as part of due process and they find that the employer made an error and they reinstate that officer because of an error that was made, they don't even look at the conduct. So the conduct doesn't get addressed. Or they may look at as they're going through the arbitration process and find that there is an issue with the conduct. We feel that in those two latter cases that the conduct should still be reviewed by DPSST since we are the agency that looks at certification. And again, most of those cases are what they're talking about, the moral fitness standards. That's why we're looking at that as well. So those are the two pieces with the arbitration. The last piece is the certification review committee. In talking about how that committee works, currently, as you've heard, the policy committees that are subcommittees of the board are the ones that do a lion's share of the legwork. Now, when these cases come from DPSST to do the review and that kind of thing. Now, what we talked about, and there's no consensus on the board with this, although we've been trying to talk about how we can structure this thing. There is a concern, as you brought up, Representative Berger, about bypassing the full board, even if this subcommittee made up of three management, three labor, and one private citizen makes a decision to go just to the administrative law judge process and bypassing the full board. So we're still having some discussions about how that group could work. There's also a level of expertise on the board which we feel would be well served in looking at these cases on a case-by-case basis. And the fact is, in looking at the arbitration case that Mr. King brought up, I've been on the board 5 years. And in hundreds of cases that we looked at, only three of them fall under what Mr. King has talked about. When an arbitrator made a decision and DPSST revoked based after arbitrator already made a decision just looking at the conduct itself, only three out of the hundreds and hundreds of cases over the past 5 years. And the other thing to remember is only out of all the cases that come to DPSST for revocation, only 16% of those actually make it to the board for us to decide on. The rest are done administratively at the DPSST level. So very few cases even come to us in the first place for us for revocation. And so since we've been working at this process and talking with the other members of the board, they just think this is just too much, too fast. And we're making all of this progress that I've just talked about with the board the way it's currently structured. And talking with the other members of the board, they think it's just too many changes too fast. They like to see just some more, continue this good work that's been started, and allow more thoughtful process to occur. And I'm making a commitment to report back to you or to whoever you designate to keep you appraised of how our progress is going and the progress that we're making to resolve the issues that have been brought forward. I am deeply committed to that. I told Mr. Glassman and Mr. King that I'm deeply committed to that. I've held two emergency meetings, which never happened before, to show my commitment to that. And I'm telling you, for the record, that I'm continuing to be committed to make this process work. We just don't feel that a legislative change is what's needed. We just think we need to change some things on how we do business on the board. And with that, I'd like to entertain any questions, unless you want to hear the testimony of my colleagues that are also here. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Wolf. I'm the sheriff of Polk County. I serve as the vice chair of the DPSST board, and I'm also here representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As Harold just shared with you, this committee has really taken this issue up. As a matter of fact, when I was the vice chair and we were lacking a chair and I quickly decided that we needed to go get a chair, I had been sent by the board to meet with Mr. DeLatte Schmidt and representatives of the labor organizations to try to talk about this issue and what it is that we could work on to address their concerns. It was the direction of the board to go there and meet with them. I did, and then reported back to the board on what had taken place. And as you've heard from Mr. King and Mr. DeLatte Schmidt, it really gets down to the bottom line is it's labor versus certification. It's labor contracts and how labor contracts are dealt with by an arbitrator versus the certification standards for public safety officers in the state of Oregon. And the issue is very clear, and it's been penciled out very decisively that if an arbitrator makes a decision that this person should be returned to work, that the certification standards mean nothing, and that person should be returned to work in this state as a public safety officer. Some of the issues that have been of concern deal with the moral fitness, but also a couple of these cases are truthfulness. One of the cases involves an officer who lied in affidavits to obtain a search warrant that interferes with a person's right to privacy, a violation of the amendments of this country. And this person was reinstated by an arbitrator because the process wasn't followed correctly. And this person now cannot write citations, cannot appear in court, cannot testify in court because the judges won't accept that testimony. This is the type of person that the standards of this state of Oregon are saying we don't want police officers that lie in an affidavit for a search warrant. I don't think the members of this committee want to believe for a minute that you've got a police officer out there that's going to lie, obtain a search warrant to enter into someone's home, and then get reinstated by an arbitrator, and DPSST, by the amendments that are put before you, are bound. They're wanting to make binding arbitration binding for the certification for police officer in this state. The DPSST board is appointed by the governor of this state. We're all appointed by the governor after getting legislative approval to carry out the duties in which we're obligated to perform. I'm rather confused because I have been to all of the different meetings with Mr. DeLatte Schmidt, and I'm really concerned as to why everything wants to turn this board completely upside down when we've been working very hard for the last 6 weeks and have already, the board has already attempted to institute some of these changes because we see the need for them. Why we're going to turn this board upside down now with this legislation this fast? The board's already trying to do the work. We've continued to have meetings. And in our last board meeting that we had, emergency board meeting, in discussing all of these issues, it came right back down to the same issue, and Mr. King testified to you already on it. It's an issue of arbitration. If the arbitrator says put them back to work, that's what they want. We're looking at certification standards. I have sat as the chair of the Corrections Policy Committee. I've heard lots of cases, and in some of those cases, I've sent the information back to staff to go out and get more information. Yes, there have been times that the members of the Corrections Policy Committee would like to have asked a few questions of the individual, and we haven't done that. But in those cases where it was really important, I've sent it back to staff to get the information and bring it back. I think members of the board are in agreement that we would like to probably have a situation to where individuals could come in, and if there were specific questions that the members of the committee wanted to ask them, then they could do so. We're looking now at the process of a special committee that would review these and then probably go to an administrative law judge, and then at that point maybe it comes back to the board after the administrative law judge has made a determination. We're looking at several different options. The board, by administrative rule, is the one that carries out these duties, and we can also, as a board, submit for changes in the administrative rules, which we would most likely have to do with some of the work that the board's already trying to do. I'm really troubled with the fact that we're going so fast. You've got 6 or 7 dash amendments in front of you today. This is an effort by the labor group to try to shotgun this whole approach through and run this through too fast. Give the board the opportunity to work on this issue that is endorsed by the legislator and appointed by the governor. One other quick point I'd like to make is we've heard a lot of testimony today about the process and how long it is. I would like the members of the committee to understand that when a officer certification is up for denial, if that's the process that it goes through, the individual does not become decertified until it's gone through the entire process. So that officer is still allowed to work. Now, if the individual agency has some reason to keep them from working, but as far as the certification that they must have in order to be a peace officer in this state, they are still allowed to work up until the point that the actual certification has been removed. So with that, members of the committee, if you have any questions, or we can go to my colleague.
Yeah, let's hear from the whole panel, and then we'll take questions.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Todd Anderson. I'm the sheriff of Tillamook, Oregon, and I'm also representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I'm a appointee by the governor who's going through Senate confirmation right now for the DPSST board, taking Sheriff Wolf's place. And I could echo many of the comments, but I will just say a couple of things that, you know, we've talked about that group of 7 that has been proposed. And, you know, we had been moving along, and then ultimately when we got the whole board involved, it really came apparent that there were some deep concerns from both state, county folks that people with the technical knowledge in those specific disciplines wouldn't be represented in that group of 7, and people who had knowledge of corrections or parole and probation and or police tactics wouldn't necessarily be in that group. And so there was a concern by the board what exactly would be left out by that process. And you've heard a lot about the arbiter's decisions, and I'm one of the poster child for the 3 that has been spoke about during this legislative session. And I have the administrative law judge's decision that I'll pass out here. But basically what it was is that I had a deputy sheriff who lied to his supervisor over the writing of a report and entering a stolen boat into the law enforcement data system. And he was terminated for untruthfulness, admitted he had lied throughout the process, and the arbiter brought him back with about 8.5 months later saying that he had lied, yes, he admitted he lied, but I think the lengthy suspension should give him a good message that, you know, it's inappropriate behavior. Unfortunately, Tillamook County is not one of those large police agencies that, you know, you can find some place to put somebody. The local legal bar, defense bar, as well as the district attorney's office is well aware of his conduct, and I had a deputy sheriff who could not perform the jobs as a police officer, and I couldn't put him out there on his own, because if he would lie about something as minute as writing a police report or whether he'd entered a stolen boat into the computer, how could I trust that individual? How could the public trust him on a more serious situation like a deadly force issue? I could not justify putting that person back into my community, knowing that I couldn't trust him. The district attorney's office had a problem with any case that would come forward, as well as he'd be challenged by the defense bar. And at one point it had been recommended in a prior hearing that I just put him in a car with another guy and he could go out and work. Well, Tillamook County, sometimes on night shift I have two cars out. And so the response to the community is deeply impacted. I also have another handout I'm going to give you today about an arbiter's decision in Nebraska where a state trooper was involved in the Ku Klux Klan and racial comments on a website, which they determined was him. They fired him. The arbiter brought him back. And ultimately, the Supreme Court upheld the decision, I believe, of the Attorney General, saying that this trooper couldn't dispense justice equally and fairly in his community, and that that was a separate licensing issue too that they had to look at. So, you know, we're looking at very few cases that has seemed to drive this bill, three or four in the past 5 years, and where the arbiter has made a decision to bring the employee back, but there was licensing and standards issue, and that's what DPSST is the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'm also concerned about the recommendations for the new makeup of the board. It would take the Director of Department of Corrections and the State Police Superintendent out of voting positions. Director Williams serves the largest community of corrections officers in the state of Oregon. And the state police, you know, we all have different functions. There's city police, there's county sheriffs, and then there's the state police. And I think that's a significant portion of our community. And so my position is I don't believe the board's broke. I think we're doing some very good things to look at our processes, but there's a very detailed due process system set up right now where the individual would hold their certification through the board, through the policy board, to the board, and ultimately to an administrative law judge, and that certification never goes away until there's been a final decision there. So with that, I would entertain any questions also.
Any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair. The you talked about being somewhat disturbed by the process around this legislation. I guess what's disturbing to me is that we've got a problem that's clearly been in place for years, and yet DPSST only within the last 6 weeks is actually getting on the problem. Only with this process and this legislation going forward over the last several months is now the board finally looking at the problem. And we're going to be gone in a month, in fact, less than a month. And so it's a little disturbing to me, frankly, to hear you say you're disturbed by us considering very legitimate legislation, very legitimate legislative process, when, frankly, DPSST has been asleep at the switch on dealing with these issues, at least prior to the last 6 weeks. I'll grant you the last 6 weeks. But that's what's disturbing to me. And I guess I have two questions coming out of that. One, are you aware, you talked about, most of what you talked about has been the concern about the arbitration process and the board being bound. Are you aware that at least the Dash 5 amendments, setting aside 4, 6, and 7, but at least the Dash 5 amendments, are you aware that those are silent on the issue of how to deal with the review of persons who have been the subject of an arbiter's decision? And I guess the second question then is, are you aware of any other certifying body of any profession in the state of Oregon that has anything like DPSST in terms of size or composition not being peers of that profession? Any other profession that has a parallel kind of group in terms of size or composition?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, in regards to the second question, no, I'm not. I'm not aware of that. I can point out, though, that a few years ago, it was the labor groups that wanted to increase or decrease the size of the board, or increase the size of the board, which was done, and now they're coming back wanting to decrease the size of the board. I'm not sure, you know, what the motive is. And then there's several of the different dash amendments. One still decreases, the other one increases. So, but in response to your question on other boards, no, sir, I don't have the answer to that. In response to your first question, if you could rephrase it, because I wanted to make sure that I...
Why it's taking so long for us?
Oh, why it's taking so long. That, I know that there's been another board member, Bob Livingston, that was on the board with me. I've been on the board for 8 years. I'm termed out. I actually filled an unexpired term, so I've been on there longer than the 6 years that you're allowed to be. And I know Bob Livingston brought this issue up a couple of times, but it hasn't been brought forward of this magnitude until just recently. And, you know, some of the folks that are on the board, if they had this issue and it was that much of a concern, their attendance record doesn't show that they're that interested in this issue because they haven't been attending the board regularly on a regular basis. And so if it's that much of a concern, I would have thought that person would have been attending the board more regularly to address those issues.
I had a question, though. Wasn't there a bill that dealt with exactly this topic last session 2 years ago? I thought there was legislation passed one chamber last session dealing with the composition of this board. So it seems like that would have made you aware that there was a serious issue.
With the composition, or Madam Chair, with the composition of the board, yes, there was legislation last year, but I don't specifically recall it being over the issue of binding arbitration. It was more of an issue of they didn't feel that there was enough labor on the board versus management. And as far as where we are today and the issues that are coming forward, it's been very clearly defined that it's a matter of binding arbitration should be the final say. I don't think it really has anything to do, Madam Chair, with all respect, I don't think it has anything to do with the makeup of the board. It has to do with binding arbitration.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you for your testimony. We have two more people, and we're going to try to hear you before we have to go to the floor. And they are Kevin Campbell and John Powell. Please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. I believe that John Powell had to run up to another hearing, so I don't believe he's available to testify. So I'll try to be brief, and I really appreciate the committee's time today. Thank you so much. I want to mention, because I've had a long history with this board on public safety standards and training.
Kevin, just identify
yourself. Oh, I'm sorry. Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. And I've had a long history with the board, and in fact, there was a time when this board was extremely large and unwieldy. About three sessions ago, I worked with Steve Marks, who was then in Governor Kitzhaber's staff, and the whole board was restructured, and it was restructured in this way. As you know, the board represents a number of different professions, including corrections, private security, police, fire, parole, and probation. There are many entities that have to serve that many masters, but DPSST is one of them. And so it's important to realize that the board itself is really a stakeholders' board. What was done about three sessions ago is the power to make decisions was changed and adjusted and placed within the policy committees. Originally, they were called advisory committees. They didn't make binding decisions. They sent decisions to the board. But with the change, it's the policy committees themselves that make the decisions. So that when these decertification issues come up, it is the specific profession that takes a look at it first. They make a recommendation to the full board, and so it is fully vetted there before it goes forward. I wanted to make that clear. In terms of the proposed bill, we have a number of concerns. We do appreciate the fact that the board is really taking action, and I think that they are truly making an effort to make adjustments in the way the board works on some of these issues. The number of cases we're talking about in the last few years is the basis for the whole bill. How many cases? A few. And when I look at one of them, Sheriff Anderson mentioned the one in Tillamook. There's also one in Malala. And before we look at unions being wanting to have these people put back to work, 13 of the officers of a relatively small Malala Police Department actually signed a letter supporting the firing of the person that was then reinstated. That's a lack of confidence, not just based on the management of that police department, but on the part of their peers as well. Over the last several years, this board has worked as a professional group. You can't make the case that this is a management-run board that just looks at ways to get rid of officers who they don't like. In fact, over the last several years, since January of 2004, there have been 178 line officers that have been decertified, 41 supervisors, a lot of them chiefs of police. And lieutenants and captains and people that are in management. This is a board that's really concerned about the profession. Now, the question was asked, can you think of a situation where peers don't review it, like a dental board or a doctor's board? This is like a board that has to handle the doctors and the dentists and all of them in one board, but they do separate out the review of these cases. Under the proposal that creates the seven-member committee, in fact, you would have less representation of the members from your own profession because of the three management and three labor members, you could have a fire member, a police member, a private security member, you could have a mix. And so, in fact, this review committee, this seven-member review committee, actually would not be as representative of your profession, and then would forward, without the board's review, the case on directly from there. And so I believe that the board is an effective board at this point. I don't see any reason to change the board structure. There is representation on the police policy committee from non-management members. In fact, there are three non-management members of the police policy committee now. I believe that is fair representation, and there is a significant voice there. And we are talking about very, very few cases here that raise to a level of concern altogether. And in the cases where they do raise to a level of concern, the idea that an arbitrator might return someone to work based on the labor contract should not prevent the board, the certification entity, from taking a look at the moral fitness issues that really impact how they do their job in terms of the credibility that we require our police officers to have. We have a higher standard for police officers, and we should, and that's what the certification standard is all about. And so I'd encourage the committee to oppose the bill altogether, frankly. I think you're given several amendments, all of them, begin with the board restructure. It's like saying, well, of course you're going to want to do the board restructure. It's just a question about how you want to handle the arbitration. We think all of those are, we'd oppose all of those and would encourage you to do that as well.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm glad you could join us, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I will not repeat testimony given by the two sheriffs that preceded me, but would only urge the committee to view the DPSST function in its totality. There are many, many responsibilities around training other than just the decertification issue that seems to have brought this issue to the fore. And that's why the board makeup is extremely important and appears to be working well. When an arbiter looks at a situation, they have to review a labor contract and other specific things, which is a different function, as has been pointed out. Again, I would just urge you to look at the totality of the function of this board as opposed to the relatively narrow issue of decertification.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel of witnesses? Okay, is there anybody else who wishes to... Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3432? Okay, we will not be taking this bill up in work session today, but we will be carrying it over to our next hearing on Monday. At that time, it is our intention to work the bill. I will close... Oh, and Mr. Stembridge, you wanted to
Madam
correct...
Madam Chair, I just wanted to correct. The policy committees under the board, I said that they were all subcommittees of the board. That's only true for the certification review committee that's proposed in the dash 4, 5, 6, 7. The other policy committees include board members and others.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3432. And members, we are adjourned.